refresh you even look refreshed. Yeah. I knew it did.
Oh.
After one day.
That's right.
You know,
one day.
We, my son and I went to Costa Rica for 3 weeks, mm-hmm. and they could not stand me. They were like, slow down. You don't have to get anywhere. You don't have to do anything.
Yeah.
It was really amazing. But as soon as I was back,
yeah.
You know, that schedule, that pace again. It's true.
Okay,
I am.
And I'll give you, you can see the clock.
The clock, so we've got till about.
I'll give you a little bit of time before.
Fantastic.
We need to change this.
Fantastic. Thank you. I am Laura Hale here at the University of Rochester Rare Book and Special Collections with Mr. Raymond Scott on July 11th, 2008. So the first one's an easy question. Tell me about some of your first experiences with activism.
Well, my first experiences primarily came through a relationship that I had with Minister Franklin Florence.
Okay.
He was my mentor. He was my friend. He was like a father figure. He was the first black man that I ever met that talked about God like he really knew him. And mm-hmm. I was a young minister at the time. And so he was ideal for me to sit under and let him tutor me and mentor me. And he was quite active in the civil rights struggle at that particular time. And Fight was just being born. Mm-hmm. He performed my wedding ceremony.
Okay. I don't think we talked about that before.
Yeah. Well, he performed my wedding ceremony. And my first son's middle name is Franklin, after him. So that's how much reverence I had for him at that particular time. And he's the most charismatic man that I've ever met. And so because he was involved in the movement, and I had some obvious concerns being black, about civil rights, and so the two just meshed together. Mm-hmm. He was quite active. He was a godly man, but he was also fiery for justice.
Mm-hmm.
And I just, you know, respected that immensely. And so I began to follow in his footsteps. And the Fight organization at that particular time had just been birthed.
Okay.
I wasn't involved. I didn't become involved until 1966, mm-hmm. Shortly thereafter, and because I was in school at the time.
I was going to ask you. You came to Rochester in 1965.
No, I came to Rochester in 1966.
Okay.
That's when I got married, mm-hmm. in 1966, and so that's when I literally moved here.
Mm-hmm.
Now we were here for a short period of time that summer, and then we went away to school. No, first we went on a missionary trip to work in New York City.
Okay.
And then after that, we came back to Rochester and stayed for a while and then went on to finish school at one of our church-affiliated schools. And that was a school in Arkansas.
And the we here is you and your
wife. My wife and I, yeah.
Okay.
And that was a school in Arkansas, in Searcy, Arkansas, Harding University now.
Mm-hmm.
And we were two of four black students that were married. There were two of us that were married, and so two black student families that were married.
Mm-hmm.
And out of about 3,000-4,000 students, and it was interesting because Harding didn't integrate probably until 1963 or 64.
Okay.
So and that was just with two black students.
Mm-hmm.
So we went down as the only two black married students on campus. And there were about 8 to 10 other blacks on the entire campus. And that was an interesting experience. We didn't really we went on campus, and they were advertising from the town for married students to rent apartments or rent you know, spaces in their homes or
sure.
rent flats. And we didn't, the marriage part, a marriage student's apartments on campus were already full.
Mm-hmm.
And so we had to go off campus looking for apartments. And it was a church town. It was, you know, we were members of the Church of Christ at the time. And most of the people in the church were in the town were mm-hmm. members of the Church of Christ. And so those people obviously were advertising on the bulletin board for apartments.
At the church?
At the school.
At the school.
The school was a mm-hmm. church-affiliated school.
Sure, okay.
And so most of the people were advertising at the school mm-hmm. for apartments. So we would call to, we'd look on the bulletin board, see where the apartments were, and then we would call.
Mm-hmm.
And we would say, we're students at Harding. Oh, really, are you? Yes, we're students at Harding and studying for the ministry. And, fine. Well, yeah, we'd be glad to have you come and take a look at the apartment. And, well, let me ask you one question. Do you rent to black people? No, we don't. Why, are you black? Yes. Well, no, we won't rent to you. So hang up, call again. Somebody else. Hello, we're members of, we're students at Harding College, and we're studying for the ministry. Oh, good. Well, good. And you go to Harding? Yes. What year are you in? Well, this is our third year. Because we came from another Christian
sure.
school in Pennsylvania for a two-year college. And so are you students at Harding? Yeah. Studying for the ministry? Yes. Good. Yeah, we'd be glad to have you come over and take a look at the apartment. Well, let me ask you a question. Do you rent to black people? No, I don't. Oh, really? Can I ask why? I just don't want them in my house. Period. Okay. Good. So, needless to say, after I went through a string of these, I was quite upset.
Sure.
And so, the president of the college, I remember one day, spoke, and he talked about faith like it was nothing. I mean, it was like there were no problems. Mm-hmm. And he just spoke like there were no problems in the world, and nobody had anything to be upset about. So I went to him after his message in chapel. And I said, Dr. Gaines, can I see you in your office? And he said, yeah, well, let me finish talking with some of the students and then you can meet me there. So I went into his office and I never will forget. I opened the door and he said, Raymond, come right in. And I shut the door and then I lit in on him. And I said, you guys are being such hypocrites. I said, I'm black. I'm a Christian. You're a Christian. And the Lord says there's no respect of persons. And you allow those white folks in this town to advertise on that bulletin board. And they won't rent to me. I'm their brother in Christ. They won't rent to me because I'm black. And you are part of that. How am I party to that? You're allowing them to advertise. Why don't you take a stand? Well, he stammered and stuttered, because most whites at that time weren't accustomed, especially down there, to black folk talking to them that
sure.
way.
Sure.
And long and short of it was, he got me an apartment on campus in the faculty apartments. And my wife was 6 months pregnant at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And so he got me an apartment on campus in faculty apartments, and but they wouldn't take the advertisements off the bulletin board. I
right.
said, well, what about the white students? Well, why not? What about what's right? What about what's right? So they had an interesting brand of Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
And it's one that I still don't understand. So all of that, and I had several experiences down there. When Martin Luther King got killed, we almost had a fight, and we had to almost put our Christianity down for a minute, because we almost had a fight. But we stood our grounds around the flagpole. The 10 to 15 total black students that were on campus. The president had ordered the flag to be flown at half staff.
Sure.
a half mass. It was a half mass. And so we went over and lowered the flag to half mass. And the white students resented it because they hated King. And so finally the president intervened and said, well, the president has said it, so we got to do it. We're good Americans, and we got to do it. So they did it, and that quelled it.
It's amazing to me that most, I find this with my college students, they cannot understand how unpopular Dr. King was with white folks when he was murdered.
Right.
It wasn't until 15 or 20 years later that his legacy starts to be reclaimed.
Yeah.
There's a memory gap there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's interesting that you bring that up.
Yeah. And so all of that just kind of laid the groundwork for me coming back to Rochester ultimately.
Mm-hmm.
To continue my mentorship under Franklin Florence, and my wife was from Rochester too, so my mother was here, and so we came back here, and I immediately became involved in community work, and immediately went to work for the fight organization, and then as a community organizer.
Okay.
And then. I ultimately became the director of Hanover House's ministry, and it was sponsored by the Rochester Area Council of Churches.
Okay. Tell me a little bit about the kind of work you did as a community organizer for FIGHT. What was the day in and day out schedule of somebody who was a community organizer?
Well, basically, we got there. We had to be there at 9.
Mm-hmm.
And then we kind of organized our day, and it was generally around identifying issues within the community. We had to read the newspaper, see what was going on, you know, in the community from the newspaper's perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And then we had to identify issues, and we got them sometimes from the newspaper, sometimes, you know, just being out in the community and mm-hmm. talking to people and meeting people. We learned what the issues were that were mounting. We organized block clubs mm-hmm. on various streets to attack the issues on that street. If it was refuse collection or slumlords
mm-hmm.
Or various property violations, then we organized the people to deal with those particular problems. And we did that on a block-to-block basis so that whenever there was an issue with city council in particular, then we put together a mass of people and went to city council and it made our voices heard. And if we had to disrupt the meeting, then we would disrupt the meeting. Or education.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing with the Board of Education. If we had to galvanize people to make a move around something that they were doing that we felt was not in the best interest mm-hmm. of our kids, then we would do that.
Can you give me an example of a particularly successful campaign that you mounted like that? Refuse cleanup, slumlords. What were the nuts and bolts? How did that process work?
Well, as an example, I guess the best one, the one that comes to mind right away, we organized people around the Cornhill Preservation District.
Okay.
At one point, early on, they wanted to make Cornhill a historic preservation district. The only problem was that most of the people that lived in the Cornhill area at that time owned property, and if, in fact, they declared it a historic preservation district, the taxes would go up.
Okay.
And people might be able to pay the mortgage, but they would not be able to pay the taxes.
Now, these are black folk that own
black
land
folks,
there?
Black folks, yes. And what was happening at the time was that there was a movement afoot to get white folks to move back into the city.
Right.
And so there was a group called New Rochester that began to buy up houses. And when they bought up houses, they had a conclave, little conclave, and they bought up these houses on this particular street, and they renovated them all. Mm-hmm. Now, they looked better than the houses that were around them, but the houses that were around them weren't necessarily bad.
Right.
But these houses were brand new.
Sure.
And so it's like the Lord says, a little leaven leavens the whole lump. So they started with this conclave, and the idea was to just expand it, mm-hmm. you know. And what that would have meant was that the black folk that were there would have been moved out. That's what they historically did through urban renewal and whatnot.
Is this in the 19th ward?
This was in the 3rd ward.
The 3rd ward. 3rd
and the 11th ward.
Okay.
And so what happened was that we fought the declaration of that particular area as far as it becoming a historic preservation district, and we disrupted meetings at the city council, and there were some people who were even threatening violence. And that was not our thing. Mm-hmm. That was never our thing. Mm-hmm. And my thing, and Franklin Florence's thing, and I learned it from him, that he said, I'm going to get out there. And I said, I won't get out there and throw one brick. I'm not going to throw one bottle. I'm not going to throw any Molotov cocktails. But that doesn't mean that there aren't some people who won't. Mm-hmm. And there were some people who would do that.
And so these were black folks?
They would do that. So we wouldn't do that. And it was just a matter of keeping a lid on those who would. Mm-hmm. So what happened was that the city council, in essence, John Perinello led the fight to rescind the movement to declare it a preservation mm-hmm. district. A guy named Bob Woods, was a city councilman at that time, big-time lawyer. He led the fight and to have it declared such.
Right.
And so we got into John Perinello and talked with him, and actually became good friends after that. And he turned it around. And Mayor, he wasn't the mayor then. His name was Frank Lamb, though. He used to be the mayor.
Yep. He
wasn't the mayor at that time. He was just a councilman because we didn't have an elected mayor then.
Correct.
The mayor was selected by the city council. Mm-hmm. So Frank Ryan, Frank Lamb mm-hmm. co-endorsed John Perinello's move to have the district rescinded.
Interesting.
So they backed off of it at that time.
So it sounds like you were working on both ends of this situation. You're trying to organize the people in one sense, mm-hmm. and you're also trying to keep some order in the neighborhood at the same time.
Yeah.
Keep control of the more unruly forces. That
yeah,
are
well, you had to do that. I mean, we weren't about any more than Dr. King was about destruction. Mm-hmm. Our tactics were a bit different than his. I mean, he was totally, totally nonviolent and disruptive in a very, very peaceful way.
Sure.
Mainly through marches and pray-ins and that kind of thing. We were a bit more vocal than that. And the tactics that were employed worked. And so, but we did want to maintain that balance. We understood at that particular time that the threat of violence was more potent than violence itself.
Why is that the case in Rochester at that moment?
Well, we didn't want to tear anything down. We didn't want to physically, you know, just destroy anything. And there's some people who did mm-hmm. want to do that, and some people who did do some of that. Mm-hmm. But that wasn't the tenor of the fight organization. And so what we did was we pushed it to the edge. Mm-hmm. We pushed it to the edge. And went as far as we could, keeping our consciences intact mm-hmm. in terms of who we were. And there were more of us than it was of them. And so we were able to keep a lid on it, but at the same time get some things done. And be recognized as militants, for lack of a better term.
Give me an example of how you see either your own actions or the actions of FIGHT pushing it to the edge or pushing it to the limit. Give me an example of what that limit was at that time.
Well, I think, again, if you look at the Preservation District, there was the whole idea that there could be trouble. And we were kind of sounding an alarm. Mm-hmm. And fortunately, that got heard.
Mm-hmm. Is that a result of the riot?
Oh, yeah, but in those times, people talk about the riots. Mm-hmm. They need to be plural in that. Mm-hmm. You know, people talk about the riots like there was only one in Rochester.
Right.
There were riots. Mm-hmm. There was the one big one, but every summer we were being called by the city mm-hmm. to come out and help quell riots consistently on Joseph Avenue. And if it sparked on Joseph Avenue, then the brothers across town on mm-hmm. Jefferson Avenue at that particular time would start the same thing.
Sure.
Or if it started on Jefferson Avenue, then it generally happened across town on Joseph Avenue. And that went on for summer after summer for a long time. I was president of FIGHT for 5 years, and there was not a year that did not happen.
And so you're president.
And there were killings, too.
You're president from 70 to 75.
Yeah.
And so this trend of these summer uprisings continues.
Just about every summer.
Okay.
Just about every summer.
Tell me about the killings. What was happening there?
Well, there was one young man that, his name was Tommy Lee Wright, if I'm not mistaken. I was a young upstart. Franklin was president at that time. And he tried to run through a roadblock.
This is 1967?
I think this was 67.
I think I've read about this.
But he ran through it, and the cops shot him and killed him. His girlfriend was in, there were several people in the car, mm-hmm. and they shot him. He didn't have a gun. Nobody's being shot at. He didn't hit anybody. You know, he didn't drive at the police officer. And they shot him. So we had to deal with that kind of thing over and over again. The killings, there were a couple of killings that just kind of come to mind. Not during those riots, but that was during a riot. Mm-hmm. Then there were there was the killing of a young lady named Denise Hawkins.
Okay.
By a police officer. And there were 5 to 6 officers in this tiny hallway, and she was probably 100 pounds soaking wet. And she had an argument with her husband and walked out of the apartment, and she had a butcher knife. And you have about 5 to 6 burly officers in this hallway. And she had the knife up like that. The long and the short of it was 5 or 6 burly officers couldn't subdue her, and one of them shot her and killed her.
He didn't just shoot her, but killed her.
He killed her, mm-hmm. Yeah. In reading the transcripts, obviously they got their stories together, but in reading the transcripts of their testimonies, it was very clear that, and I don't know which of the officers it was, but it's very clear that at least one of them was half-hearted in revealing, you know, what he saw. And it was like the stories were contrived. And this guy it was clear that he didn't want to go along with it.
Sure.
In reading the transcripts, but he did. Mm-hmm. So the guy that killed the guy off. So you had that kind of thing going on. And those are the two things, two that just come to mind right now.
It's interesting what your stories bring to my mind are that police brutality is such a huge issue in Rochester before you're here. Mm-hmm. 1961, 62, 63, you have the Rufus Farewell case, you mm-hmm. have the Black Muslim trials, you have the A.C. White case, mm-hmm. and there's all of this organizing around police brutality, mm-hmm. the police review board is created, but it sounds like in the later 60s you have the police really stepping up the violence in some ways. But I haven't seen that same kind of community outcry against the police. Why is that? Do I have that wrong? Was there?
During which period of time?
If we're looking at 65 to 70 or 75, what's happening in response to this police brutality and harassment then?
Well, I think we're speaking out on it more. And back then, there were a lot of things that were done that were not reported. Prior to, I'd say, the late 60s and on into the 70s,
okay.
prior to then.
Okay.
But every time, I remember a young man came, his mother brought him to my house, and I forgot how I even knew him. And his eye was swollen up as big as, and I mean literally, as big as a golf ball. And this kid was about 14 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And what had happened was that he had been kicked in the eye by a police officer. And when we were always going down and pressing charges. We were always going down to internal affairs. And when we would, a lot of the cases, we never got any word back on.
Right.
But in this one, I remember following up with this one and following up with it. And I remember going to one of the internal affairs officers that did the investigation. And I remember his saying to me at that particular time, well, here's what we know. We know there were two officers present. We know that the kid was kicked. We just don't know which one did it. And so that was the end of it. We know he was kicked. We know that something took place. We just don't know which one did it.
And that was it.
Was it. Yeah. So there were a lot of people who were growing increasingly angry about this kind of stuff. And I think the complaints consistently led ultimately to more black police officers on the force. At that particular time, there weren't many at all.
They added more
black police
officers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you find that all over the place in so many different situations. I mentioned to you the last time we talked, when we went to Attica in 1971,
mm-hmm.
There were no black prison guards. None.
There's still very few in New York State.
Yeah. But there were none at that particular time.
Mm-hmm.
It was interesting to go back some years later after the Attica riots and see some.
Mm-hmm.
But at that particular time, and that's one of the things that was a part of the manifesto of the prisoners
mm-hmm.
during the Attica riots and in the riots in Auburn as well.
Mm-hmm.
That they wanted more black prison guards. So there was nobody, and there was one guy. I'm going back to Rochester mm-hmm. situation. There was one guy. There was a riot on Jefferson Avenue, and cars were coming through. They were just trying to get out of the area.
Sure.
And the policemen were hitting the cars with their billy clubs. Get on through, hitting the cars. And there was a guy named Ike Carson, okay. who was a black police officer. And he started yelling to those guys, stop hitting those cars. Stop hitting those cars. And there was they had established at that particular time a tactical unit.
Okay.
This was the tactical force.
Mm-hmm.
I forget the guy's name. I can almost see his face. But he was the leader of the tactical unit. And he told Ike, he said, Officer Carson, if you don't like what you're seeing, then get the hell out of the area. He said, well, no, I don't like what I see because it's wrong. Ike said, I don't like what I see because it's wrong. He said, then get the hell out of the area now. And he was Ike's boss, a sergeant or something like that.
A superior.
So, yeah, superior. Mm-hmm. So he said, get the hell out of the area. And he said to his partner, who was white, he said, come on, let's go. He said, no, you go. You stay. Get the hell out of the area. So he left. He came to us the next day to tell us about it. In my office at fight.
And this is the fight office.
The fight
office. He came to fight.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And we went down and met with the police chief.
Is it still Lombard at this time?
No. This was, that's what I mean when I say there were more riots.
Mm-hmm.
Mistrella.
Okay.
John Mistrella.
Yep.
And went down and met with him. And he said, he listened. And then John said he would look into it. Yeah, he did. And what happened was I got put on in the car pound, guarding the car pound.
He's reassigned.
Yeah. That's how they dealt with it.
Right.
You know, for going outside.
Right.
You know, he get reassigned. And he never did get a promotion as a result of that. Never did. He remained a police officer.
Right.
Never got a promotion. He's retired now.
Mm-hmm.
But different guys would come and tell us different things. And, but that's that. So we continue to fight them, though, and we continue to expose them. And as a result of the exposure, some changes were made.
Okay.
I think that by and large, we've worked up to where we are today. There is some degree of civility now. In terms of the way they work with people, there is some degree of sensitivity now. That doesn't mean that it's perfect.
Right.
But I think all of that groundwork was laid mm-hmm. back then.
Sure.
And you do have a significant number of blacks on the police force now.
Okay.
In Rochester.
You mentioned...
And in high-level positions, too. It's not enough to just be on.
Is the police chief black now?
Yes.
I think I saw him on TV last night.
Yes.
Paid some attention to it.
Yeah.
If we could go back to your comments about Attica in 1971, mm-hmm. were you there as the president of FIGHT?
Yes.
What was your role? What was your position? How did that come about?
It was interesting. People at that particular time looked to the FIGHT organization for anything in time of crisis. I mean, whatever.
These are city officials. These are... community members.
Everybody. They
fight
looked
was
to
it.
Fight.
Mm-hmm.
There were other agencies that ran programs, and that was good. Urban League was around. ABC was around. But when there was a crisis, when when people wanted action, you know, then they looked to the FIGHT organization, mm-hmm. even to do things that we couldn't do. They looked to the FIGHT organization.
Sure.
And so when the Attica riots jumped off, I got a call. I wasn't even aware of it. I got a call from some of the ladies who were relatives of some of the guys that were in there.
Those who were incarcerated.
Incarcerated.
Mm-hmm.
And saying, well, we want to come over and talk with you. And I'm here with the lady that called me was Annette Thomas. She's like a sister to me, and Scotty, we want to come over and talk with you because we want to find out. We can't get any information. We don't know anything, and our loved ones are there, and you know. So we want to come over and talk with you and see what you can do. Give us some direction. So they came over, and they explained what had happened. In the meantime, between the time that they got there, I had gotten some more news mm-hmm. about it. And so after they finished talking, I got on the phone, and I was a commissioner on the Rochester Housing Authority at the time.
Okay.
And so I called one of my colleagues, a guy named Don Corbett, mm-hmm. who later was elected judge and administrative judge even. Mm-hmm. And I called Don, and I said, Don, I got some ladies here. They're trying to get some information. And so they're looking to us for some guidance in terms of how they can get that information to check on the status of their loved ones and everything. But they can't get anything, and they don't know what to do. Well, I'll be right over. So he picked up, he and John Perinella were good friends, which was kind of odd because they were Democrat and Republican. Mm-hmm. And they were good friends. Both of them were attorneys. And so he said, I'll be right over. So he picked up John Perinella, who at that time was the vice mayor.
Not the chief of police still.
No, John Perinella.
Okay, I'm getting them confused.
Yeah, you think about John Mastrella.
Yes.
Yeah. John Perinella was the vice mayor at that time. And so John came over with Don. And as I look back at that, John was, he was in the midst of all those black people. And that was kind of awkward for him. But he was stoic. Mm-hmm. But very helpful. Very helpful, and always been very upfront, mm-hmm. always. And so John said, we explained the situation, he said, well, so let me call Andy Maloney. Well, Andy was the undersheriff of Monroe County.
Okay.
And the Monroe County Sheriff's Department, along with other sheriff's departments, in addition to state troopers, were being asked to come down and support the local police and the guards and all of that in trying to retake the prison. So he said, he called Andy Maloney because he knew that they were going down the following morning. The Monroe County Sheriff's were going down mm-hmm. to help out. So he called Andy and wondered if we could ride down with them. We wanted to speak to, my thinking was, I knew that Arthur Eve, who was the assemblyman from Buffalo, mm-hmm. Had been on the committee that dealt with the prisons, and so he was there. He had been involved with Attica, and he was there on the first when the thing jumped off, and so we wanted to talk with him and find out what was going on. And whatever he said, Arthur was a black guy, so mm-hmm. whatever he said, we could report back.
Sure.
And people would accept that. Mm-hmm. So my objective then was to simply get there, get on the grounds, and see Arthur Eve.
Right.
Okay. And Andy Maloney said, yeah, he would talk to the sheriff, Sheriff Alf Skinner. But he thought it would be okay if we rode down behind the motorcade the next day, mm-hmm. and they were going down like about 4 o'clock in the morning, something
right.
like that. So he talked to Andy, and Andy said okay, but he would talk to the sheriff, but have us meet. He wanted us to meet them at the public safety building at 4:30 in the morning.
Okay.
So I called Reverend Marvin Chandler. Mm-hmm. Asked him if he'd be willing to drive down. Well, just told him to drive down. I wasn't going by myself, so, you know. And Marvin said, yeah, and we were good friends and all. So he said, yeah. I woke him up, as a matter of fact, that night, probably about 12, midnight, something like that. So we went down. We got down to the motorcade, and Sheriff Skinner lived in the public safety building. He literally lived in it.
Okay.
Yeah. His apartment was in the public safety mm-hmm. building. That's where he lived. And so he came out, and Andy explained to him what he said. Yeah, let him ride down behind us. So we drove, because they needed to get us through the roadblocks.
Right.
And so we rode down behind them.
I would think especially difficult for black men in
yes.
this moment.
Yes. So we rode down, and it's interesting. Hit the paper the next day. Minister Ray Scott, President of FIDA, and Reverend Marvin Chandler were escorted to Attica by the Mono County Sheriff's Department. It wasn't the case at all.
Right.
But that's the way it hit the paper.
Mm-hmm.
I learned as a result of those kinds of things, even to this day, as far as the papers are concerned, to appreciate what Saul Alinsky said. And it's like, I don't care what they say about me as long as they spell my name right. Because
right.
I mess up anything else. So we got down there, and we got through the roadblocks, and we got on the grounds, and there were newspaper reporters and townspeople all around, because some of their loved ones, all of their loved ones worked in the prison.
Sure.
And so they were all over the grounds. So we just kind of walked and waited and looked for Arthur Eve to either come out or show up. And we asked whether he was there yet. He wasn't there yet. And I looked up, and here he pulled up his car, and he got out of his car, and I went right over to Martha, Minister Ray Scott from Rochester, and Reverend Marvin Chandler, and look, our folk are concerned about what's going on in there, and they want to hear from you.
And this is, I assume, outside the gates?
Outside the gates.
At this point?
Yeah, on the ground.
Yep.
Outside the gates.
Yeah.
And so he said, well, okay, he said, let me go inside. He said, and I need to speak with Commissioner Oswell,
mm-hmm.
and I'll come back out and fill you in. So he said, okay. We said, okay. So felt mission accomplished. You know, he's going to come out. He goes inside, comes back out. He's looking, and he sees us, and comes right at us again. He said, listen, he said, I just talked to the commissioner, and he wanted to know if you two ministers would be willing to come in and go into D Yard with him, and with us, he said, with us, along with this guy named Tom Steele, who's an attorney that came out of New York.
Also black?
No, he was white.
He was white, okay.
And, but all the prisoners knew him because he
right.
you know,
handled their cases
and whatnot.
Sure.
So, they said, we said, yeah, definitely. So he said, okay.
How were they conceiving your role at that point? Had they conceived a role at that point?
Had who?
The commissioner that's asking for the two of you to come in.
Well, they were trying to bring the thing to a halt.
Mm-hmm.
And they were looking for as much help as they could get to make mm-hmm. that happen.
I think what I'm asking, Mr. Scott, is was it because you were black or was it because you were ministers?
Both.
Okay.
Both.
Mm-hmm.
And the president of FIGHT.
And
in
did Rochester. Did the Attica inmates know FIGHT?
The local guys did.
Okay.
As a matter of fact, and that was going to be my next point.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Go ahead.
When we went inside the prison, I remember Andy Maloney came up to me. As we started to walk through the crowd and go into the prison, he said, Ray, what's going on? I said, they've asked us to come inside and meet with the inmates and see if we can, you know, help out. And he said, wow. He said, well, I thought I was going to have to be giving you information. I guess I have to look to you for something now. And we just kind of chuckled and walked on off. And we went inside the prison. And we had to sign these waivers and
sure.
you know, and all of that. And if we got killed, and it wasn't their fault, and all that kind of stuff. So we walked on in, and they took us through all the gates and everything, and met with Commissioner Oswald, and he explained the situation. And he was looked upon at that particular time as a reformer.
Okay.
and as a liberal reformer, as far as the prison system was concerned. So he explained the situation, and we walked in. And they had a gauntlet set up when we got into D Yard, D Block. They had a gauntlet set up, and you walk this way, then walk that way, then walk that way. And there was a table up front where the inmates were, who were kind of, for lack of a better term, the identified leaders.
Sure.
And so we made our way up to the table. But the interesting thing about that was as we walked, it was like old home week for me. Because I saw so many guys that I knew. And I felt safe, felt very safe. And I remember the guy, the inmates were they had guards like, and they were, you know, just kind of on the outskirts of the gauntlet.
Mm-hmm.
And so the guys were behind the gauntlet as you went down this way and went down that way.
Sure.
The guys were inside,
yep.
They're behind the gauntlet. And I heard a guy say, "Minister Scott, Minister Scott. Scotty, hey, Scotty." And I was hugging guys and you know, and just shaking hands and embracing guys. And I mean, that I knew.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm from Buffalo originally. Even some of the guys from
sure.
Buffalo, I saw a guy that lived right behind me.
Mm-hmm.
I lived on Cedar Street in Buffalo. He lived right behind me on Walnut Street. And our houses buttressed each other. And so I hadn't seen some of these guys in a while. It's a guy that I went to school with, played basketball on the same team. I didn't know he was in Attica.
Right.
And so a guy that was a track star in Buffalo that I knew, and he knew me, and I said, and I called his name. He said, he was sitting down on the ground with his legs crossed. And he said, "Hey, Raymond." And I said, "Oh man, you know, just."
Mm-hmm.
And he later got killed in the riot.
Yeah.
So that part gets kind of, you know, hard for me. So I need a breakdown.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's I think the job of the. The role of the historian sometimes is to try to translate to the audience that this is not a textbook you're reading about, that these are real people with real experiences.
Yeah.
And there's, particularly with prison work, there is such a dehumanization of inmates that somehow they cease to be people once they're behind bars.
Yeah.
And I don't know if I shared this with you, but I worked in the prison system for 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
I did HIV counseling and testing.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the most difficult things for me was following the rules of social distance.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm talking to these men about their sex lives, about their drug habits.
Mm-hmm.
I've just told them they have HIV, and you want me to keep a social distance?
Yeah.
You know, it's
just
that kind of stuff doesn't happen. And so all of that was to say I very much appreciate how difficult it is to play a role, a mediating role,
mm-hmm.
to be between these different social worlds when you are deeply personally involved in what you're doing.
Yeah. Every time I don't talk about this much, but every I'm on. You okay? We're back on.
Okay. You're on.
Okay. I don't really talk about it much, and I mean that's been good. It's gracious. I don't even know how many years ago, and I still have difficulty talking about it.
Sure.
But we went there. We went up to the table, and L.D. Barkley was at the table, who was from Rochester.
Mm-hmm. He's an enemy.
He's an enemy.
Mm-hmm.
And very articulate. Some of my whole experience there made me mindful of the fact that some of the sharpest minds that I had ever experienced were locked up.
That's right.
And those guys, LD was articulate, I mean, bright, substantive. I think of guys like Roger Champton.
Mm-hmm.
They called him Champ. Extremely, extremely articulate. And I remember this guy they called Brother Flip. And I remember at one point he stood up and he gave the most impassioned speech I think I've ever heard in my life. And he concluded by saying, we have determined that if they will not allow us to live as human beings, then we will at least try to die like men. And the place just exploded. But all of that took place during the 2 to 3 days we were there. And
so you stayed on.
Yeah.
This did not just become a.
No. No, we were there for, I guess we got there Saturday. I don't know if it was Friday morning. I think it was Friday morning we got there. Stayed on Saturday. I think we went home. Quick check on my family. Came right back.
Mm-hmm.
And stayed there Saturday night to Sunday night. And were there when they did the killing on Monday morning. But when the other point that I was going to make was when we got to the table, they asked us to speak, and they were glad to see people coming from the outside.
Mm-hmm.
They had wanted other people to come too.
Mm-hmm.
They wanted Bobby Seale from the Black Panthers, or Huey Newton. They wanted Bill Kunstler, who was a renowned attorney at that time, and others like that.
Okay.
Newspaper reporters, Tom Wicker from the New York Times.
Mm-hmm.
These are people they were demanding to come, and then demanding to be let inside. And it just kind of got out of hand in terms of, because some people that were, by and large, it were all people of quality. There were a couple of nuts that just kind of snuck in there. So what happened was they asked us to speak, identify ourselves, and they gave us a rousing applause and thanked us for being here and helping and all of that. It was just four of us at the time. It was five. Arthur Eve, Tom Steele, Commissioner Oswald, Marv Chandler, myself.
Mm-hmm.
We were the first five in there. And at that time, one of the brothers stood on the table with a picture of it in the New York Times. I had just finished speaking. And identified with them. And it went well. And then,
what do you say? What do you recall saying? I mean, you obviously didn't know you were going in. It wasn't prepared. It's got to be off the cuff.
Yeah. Well, I spoke in terms of we, not them.
Okay.
And we, in terms of the changes that we want made and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And identified with them. The changes were legitimate. And so identify with them, and I spoke in terms of not us and them, but we.
Yeah.
And they heard that. And the proof of their hearing that was one of the guys stood up, and this picture is in the papers if you look at some of the, mm-hmm. the historical stuff in the New York Times. Mm-hmm. He was there because the newspapers were there too. They locked them inside. And this guy was standing on a table. He had jumped on a table, and he was standing on a table. He's pointing down to Oswald, you know, just kind of reading Riot Act to him, and he said, "We don't have to let you out here. We just might keep you here." Oswald was cool. He didn't say anything. I remember, and I took the mic at that point, and I said, "Wait a minute, brothers." I said, "We guaranteed this man safe passage in here and safe passage out." I said, "Now, whether or not they keep their word about promises that they made, we're going to keep ours." And all the prisoners said, yeah. Mm-hmm. So we talked a little more, and we left. And they let him go out. I remember I was getting some water at a fountain in the administrative building, and Oswald said, "Reverend, you're a good man."
Are there negotiations taking place at this point?
Yeah.
Are you mediating? How is that happening?
Just looking at the list of the demands that they made, they had just really formulated them. Mm-hmm. And they were all reasonable. I forgot what they were, 21 or something like that, but 18 or 21. But they were all reasonable. The only one, and they were all reasonable at the time. All of them were.
Yep.
With the exception of guaranteed safe passage to a foreign country of their choice, and you know, being
probably never going to happen.
Not going to happen. Yeah, that won't happen. But most certainly, what they wanted was immunity from prosecution for the events in
Attica, for whatever they had done.
No, right. So what happened was, when we got up. When I was still around that fountain, and Oswald said, "Reverend, you're a good man. You know, thank you." When we got around that fountain, after he said that, he said, "You know," he said, "this whole thing changes if that prison guard dies." He said, "This whole thing changes." He said, I can't guarantee some of these things, and especially the immunity, if the guard dies." And so the whole thing was just almost like, it was almost like surreal mm-hmm. to me at that time.
Sure.
And when Quinn died, because he got thrown off a catwalk.
Okay, I'm not familiar with the ins and outs of the chronology.
Yeah.
So Quinn, I assume, is an officer.
He was an officer.
Okay.
And when they took over the prison, he was in the way, and they threw him off the catwalk.
I see.
You know, and he was injured.
Not dead yet.
Not dead yet.
But injured.
But injured. Well, he later died.
Right.
And so Oswald already told me that if he dies, that this whole thing changes.
Right.
And he came to me later and said, "You know, I can't guarantee what they want now." He said, "I can't guarantee it." It was a matter of how much we could get. What they could agree to at that particular point, but more importantly, it was a matter of ending the standoff.
Sure.
And it was that the negotiations were just going nowhere, and it was simply a matter of ending the standoff. And I remember one of the guys from the guy, he ran, he was the editor of the, I think it was the Amsterdam News. His first name was Clarence, I forgot his last name. He came up to me, he said, Ray, he said, they're going to kill these brothers. He said, they're going to kill them. You know. And again, it was like, that can't happen.
That's surreal.
Yeah. That can't happen. Mm-hmm. And so they said, the night before, we were in the administrative building, and Oswald was talking with us. And
so this would be Sunday night?
Sunday night.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just sitting, listening and looking, and Bill Gator, the guy that was president of the Build Organization in Buffalo, which was comparable to Fight.
The counterpart of Fight.
Counterpart of Fight.
Sure.
He stood up, man, and he gave probably one of the most impassioned speeches, emotional, and I remember sitting next to a guy from I think it was Detroit Free Press out of Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
And when Bill finished, he was walking the floor like a preacher, mm-hmm. like a black preacher, walking mm-hmm. the floor, just talking, and everybody was listening, and Oswald was listening. And he was talking about black fathers being taken away from the children and killed. And I was sitting next to this guy, and he said, man, he said, I feel like crying after that stuff. You know? It was very, very emotional, very passionate speech. And I watched Oswald, and he didn't say anything. And I said, Mr. Oswald, I said, it appears to me that you know what you're going to do and when you're going to do it. And he just looked. And he didn't say anything. And then he just turned around and just kind of began to walk, pacing like, didn't say anything. And we said at that point, we better stay here overnight.
Yeah.
We better stay here overnight.
Are we at time? I thought so. It was always one of the most interesting lessons in my life thus far about race I learned in the prison system. And that was that those prison officials would put on a face for black activist groups coming in,
mm-hmm.
ABC.
Mm-hmm.
Always came to the prisons I worked at, mm-hmm. Groveland and Livingston.
Mm-hmm.
And as soon
you
as
mean
they
ABC, were, Action for Better Community?
Action for Better Community. Mm-hmm. Gary Andrews I worked with. I don't know if you're familiar
no.
with him. And as soon as those men left, you got that real story. You know, whatever they would pay lip service, they would say, oh, we're going to do this, we're going to do that.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Mm-hmm.
And then as soon as they left, it was, don't give them anything, you know. You don't let them in here. It was just a very different mm-hmm. story.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I didn't work for the prisons. I worked for the Department of Health. But mm-hmm. I had this role. And they had no problem saying these things in front of me because to them, I was white, and so my loyalty mm-hmm. was to
mm-hmm.
them.
Mm-hmm.
It was, they could not understand that my professional loyalties would be in a different direction.
Mm-hmm.
My
mm-hmm.
racial loyalty was supposed to trump that.
Mm-hmm.
So it's interesting to try to sort through, listening to your stories, somebody, is it Osgood, Oswald?
Oswald.
Mm-hmm. To try to understand where his loyalties were in that mm-hmm. moment and how they were divided.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that there was something about him, in all fairness, that was good.
Mm-hmm.
There was something about him that was good. And as I said, he was looked upon as being a reformer
mm-hmm.
in the prison system.
Mm-hmm.
by some of the inmates too. And the fact that he would even come into DR was monumental. And this is on the hills, understand, that a lot of them may have been facing very, very serious penalties because they had thrown this guard off the catwalk.
Right.
And the fact that he would come into DR, and like the one guy was saying, we don't have to let you out. We may not let you out of here.
Right.
You know.
And that wasn't posturing.
No. And he came back and back until he was finally told, you can't go back in there. If I'm not mistaken, the governor.
I was going to ask.
Ordered him not to go back in.
Is it Rockefeller?
Rockefeller. Yeah. Yeah.
And so you all make the decision on Sunday night, we're going to stay overnight.
Yeah. Some of them were going to have to go. They didn't have to. For personal reasons, they had to go.
Sure. Has the group grown at this point?
Yeah, it had grown.
They've called in who now? Who has joined you?
Let's see. Bill Gator came. He wasn't there at one of the original five.
Okay.
See, Dave Anderson, Dr. David Anderson, who was here in Rochester. A guy named Kenyatta. Bill Kunstler. Tom Wicker. Clarence Williams, I think his name was. Y.T. Walker, who was on the governor's staff.
Kenyatta is a local person, a state person?
I don't know where Kenyatta came from.
Okay.
He was not cool.
Okay.
Not cool. He was talking about just very inflammatory. If they won't do what we want to do, we'll burn this mother down. Mm-hmm. Man, how you going to burn a brick?
Sure.
Yeah, so.
Sure.
Yeah, just inflammatory. So I forget, but those were some of the other people that came. I'm missing maybe a couple, but those are the ones that I recall.
And at this point, Florence is not.
Franklin came.
He did come.
Yeah, he came.
Okay.
Yeah, he came. He came, I think it was Saturday. He came Saturday.
How did that transpire?
He just came. Most of the people that, there were a lot of people, I can't say a lot, that were not asked to come. They just came. They went where the action was, and Franklin was one. He just came.
And he had the same access that you all had. He was going into the yard. He was.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
How, I mean, to your knowledge, the best of your knowledge, how was the state making decisions at that point about who was going to go in and who wasn't?
I think that was pretty much left up to, I think Oswald at that particular point had significant input into that. I think as time went on, and they could see that it wasn't going the way they wanted it to go, I think he was taking more and more out of the loop. You know, his liberal tendencies were
sure.
Remember, you're dealing with a Republican administration, both national and state now.
And he's not ending it fast enough.
And he's not ending it fast enough. So, and I think, too, that the more and more people that came, the more and more emboldened the inmates became, seeing they had this kind of support. But in the final analysis, when I went back a year later, I said something, having been able to step back from it, and it became very clear the points that they were trying to make then. And I spoke to the group.
The inmates.
I spoke to the people that came up in support of the inmates a year later.
Yep.
On the anniversary, the first anniversary of the riots. And I said that we, when we were riding home, Marv Chandler and I, after the riots and after the killing, I said to Marv, we neither one of us said anything for a while, and then I just kind of turned to him and said, man, this whole thing was like they were saying, listen to me, listen to me, listen to me. We got problems here, listen to me. And he said, yeah, it's like they were saying, listen to me or I'll die. And I said, yeah. Well, I've said that to the group, and I said, it became clear that when they did what they did, they were saying, listen to me, or I'll die. But in begging to be listened to, they weren't speaking to Governor Rockefeller. They weren't speaking to Commissioner Oswald. They weren't even speaking to President Nixon. They were speaking to us, the people, saying, listen to me. Listen to me. Because they understood that if we only knew what you said, the inhumanity that was going on behind those walls, the people would be so appalled that we would rise up and demand change.
Right.
And I said, so our presence here today is to let them know that we heard what they were saying. And we will never forget them, but instead we will always remember Attica, remember Attica, remember Attica. And that became the slogan. Mm-hmm. We will always remember Attica, remember Attica. Well, we did that. And but going back to the night, mm-hmm, before, we stayed overnight, and next morning they came in to brief us. They were getting ready to retake the prison. We had the option of staying in the administration building or leaving. And some of us chose to stay. And they said, if you're going to stay, here's what you need to do. And they told us to tape up our sleeves, tape up our pants, you know, mm-hmm, to our legs, and anything that would be exposed, you know, because they were going to use tear gas. And the gases were going to be so strong that they were going to come right in through the administrative windows, mm-hmm, in spite of the fact that the windows were down.
Sure.
And they did. We had to wet scarves around our faces, and because the stuff would burn. Mm-hmm. And the eyes were burning. Boy, they were burning. And we could look out and we could see them shooting from the catwalk, and told us to stay away from the windows. Yeah, but we didn't.
How can you do that?
Yeah. But we could look out and see them shooting from the catwalk. The guards were not supposed to be shooting, but they were up there.
And Quinn has died at this point?
Quinn has died, yeah. He has died.
Their brother.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But they were not even supposed to be involved of the retaking of the prison. Mm-hmm. And it was just so interesting. It was almost like, just think about different things that happened. It was a posturing. It was almost like, again, even to the inmates, I'm sure that the whole thing was surreal. Because somehow or another, they managed to get their hands on a couple of flare guns, mm-hmm, rifles, or, you know, mm-hmm, tear gas guns, mm-hmm, and they were handling those things like when you walk through the gate, mm-hmm, you had to go through the gate to, they, the inmates would greet you at the gate. They had masks around their faces, and they had these they had sticks, you know, that you use in a gang fight. Like, you know, they had sticks. And they were treating them like they were real weapons. Mm-hmm. I mean, and then a couple of them had the tear gas guns that they had taken, or flare guns that they had taken from some of the officers. There were two of them about, and they were treating them like they were in the army, like they really had a weapon. Mm-hmm. And it was almost like role playing. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What could that do against what they had? Mm-hmm. You know. And so we stayed there, and after they did the killing, I remember, I forget, this, the deputy commissioner under Oswald came in and he said, "Well, it's over." He was smiling. "It's over." And he said, "I got to tell you, it was an excellent assault," or something to that effect. "And the prisoner's been retaken. Being an ex-Navy man myself, they did a magnificent job." We didn't know how many people were killed, but we later began to find out that they were saying that they didn't get all the inmates who were watching the prisoners and who were watching the hostages, and some of the prisoners, some of the hostages were killed with their throats slashed and so on and so forth. And as you know, it was reported after the autopsies were done that all the inmates, all the hostages died of gunshot wounds. Nobody was killed.
By inmates.
By inmates.
Right.
Nobody was killed by inmates. So, needless to say, that was a pivotal point. We came back. We began to organize for their support. And raise a legal defense fund. As a matter of fact, it's so interesting that we've been talking about it, because I was at a funeral Monday. A young lady named Barbara Felder. And her brother was in Attica at that time. We were going, when they started the trial, somebody had been to one of the courts in Warsaw, one of the court sessions in Warsaw, and came back to me at fight. I didn't even know it was going on. He came back to me at fight. He said, "Scotty," he said, "I was down to Warsaw, man." He said, you need to go down there. You need to see that, see what they're doing to the brothers down there. They're railroading the brothers." And so I said, "Okay, what's the next court date?"
So, I'm sorry to interrupt you, Mr. Scott, but these cases are being tried in Warsaw.
Mm-hmm.
They're not in a higher level court. I mean, this is local justice.
Mm-hmm. In Warsaw. So we said, I said, "Well, okay, when is the next court case?" And he told me. And so I said, "Well, why don't we, you know, maybe six of us drive down. We get in the car, piled into a couple of cars."
And this is a fight delegation?
Fight delegation, yeah. And so we drove down to Warsaw, and he was right. He was definitely right. So at that point, I became committed to to them and putting an end to that. So we started going down, and I told the brothers, I said, "We'll be back." Because they could see us through the window, so they... When we had to leave the courtroom, and they were going to take them back to Attica.
Yep.
So I said, "We'll be back." I said, "And this time we're bringing some people with us." Said, okay. So we went back, had a press conference, held some meetings, organized community. And we went back, I think, with about two busloads of people. And when we did, they were ready. Everybody had to be searched. They went up one at a time, and everybody couldn't go up because they did the capacity thing.
Sure.
Everybody couldn't go up. So we were switching, rotating people. Mm-hmm. Well, we did this a couple of times, and I think the first time I made a mistake, I think maybe we took one busload of people. The next time we went back, we took two. And Barbara Felder and her mother went with us, and her brother and son was going to be there that day. Mm-hmm. And he had a rather minuscule role in the whole thing, mm-hmm. but he was one of the prisoners who was caught up in it. And so when that happened, he did come up, and they set bail for him at $500. And it was always, I've always found that in community organizing, Alinsky always said, you can count on the establishment to do the wrong thing at the right time.
That's right.
And this whole thing of just going back and forth to court was kind of getting stale. And they set bail for this one guy, and it was like, why don't we raise the money right now so we can take him home with us?
So he's an Attica inmate.
He's an Attica inmate.
His time was, he had served his time, and then he was only holding on for these new charges? How did that
work? I'm not sure just what that was, but he had new charges for this.
Sure, okay.
And so the long and short of it was that they put up $500 bail, which was a lot of money back then.
Right.
And so people were saying, one of my friends, another minister, Clarence Sharp, mm-hmm. We call him CJ. I said, look, man, why don't we raise the money and take him home? He said, yeah. So, okay. Why don't we pray about it? So we stopped and prayed, he and I. Good. Let's do it. So we started putting that through the crowd, and everybody began to smile. Everybody perked up and everything.
They're doing something.
Yeah, we're doing something.
Right.
And like I said, it was getting kind of stale. Mm-hmm. But now we're doing something. Yeah. Let's do it. So people came out of their pockets to raise $500. And that's a lot of money. And we told the attorney that was representing the brothers what we were going to do. He beamed. He said, yeah, I got it. He's one of those poor folk lawyers.
Right.
And he said, I got $10, I'd be willing to contribute to that. So we did, we raised it. His mother thought it was a miracle. She's been loving on us ever since to this very day. Mm-hmm. Well, his sister just passed away.
Yeah.
But we the long and short of it was, we brought him home with us on the bus. And that was a big deal. That was a real big deal.
How is all of this being received in Rochester at this time? Attica is slightly removed. It's obvious there's this relationship back and forth between mm-hmm. Rochester, Attica, and Buffalo. Mm-hmm. How is the Rochester communities responding to Fight's involvement with this?
Well, they appreciated it. Some people didn't want it to divert us from more local issues. Mm-hmm. But by and large, there was an appreciation and respect. The long and short of it was that I found that if Fight was in the newspaper, then people were happy.
Black people.
Yeah, black mm-hmm. people were happy. If they were in the newspaper, if they were on the radio, if they were on the television, then black people were happy. Mm-hmm. If they weren't in the newspaper, on the radio, on the television, people wanted to know, what's happening with Fight? Fight's not doing anything. Fight's not doing anything. Mm-hmm. So whether it was Attica or something else, mm-hmm. If we were in the news, the community as a whole were
happy.
Mm-hmm. It was happy. So. Mm-hmm. If we were in the news, they were happy. They realized we were doing something. There were always the naysayers.
Sure.
But by and large, if we were doing anything, that they knew that if they had some place, if they needed something to be done, Fight was the place to go. Mm-hmm. They didn't by and large go to ABC. They didn't by and large go to the Urban League when they needed action, whether it was police brutality, whether it was a situation on their job, you know, where they were being mm-hmm. discriminated against, or mm-hmm. any whatever. If they were trying to buy a car, they were discriminated against. Mm-hmm. You know, fight was where they came.
Mm-hmm. Is that... I have seen in Franklin Florence's papers here in the archive that in his period, anyhow, people came to him. They came to him. There's some papers. Trent Jackson mm-hmm. was trying to get hired as a coach at one of the high mm-hmm. schools and had problems. And mm-hmm. there are letters from stenographers who are trying to get jobs, and they're engaged in this sort of back and forth with a company, and Franklin Florence is copied. Mm-hmm. I've always sort of wondered about that mm-hmm. process. Mm-hmm. Was Franklin Florence's name enough to get attention to these matters?
Oh, yeah.
Tell me a little bit about that.
Well, Franklin, I was saying to people in the most recent issue that we just dealt with in terms of the public defender, at one of our meetings, when I was introducing him, and I said, if you have a job in this town and you're black, you're to this man. And that's not an exaggeration. Mm-hmm. That is really not an exaggeration, which is one of the reasons why I agreed to do this. Mm-hmm. Because there are people that walk around in Rochester, black people in particular, who work at Kodak or Xerox, and they, you know, stick the chest out and everything. And the point is, a foundation was laid for them. They don't know how they got there. You know, or if they do know, they've forgotten, and they need to be reminded. Mm-hmm. And he did things when they weren't popular. And he laid the groundwork for people like myself to get out there and put it all on the line for some of this to happen. But he's the guy that laid the foundation. And he was powerful at that particular point. Mm-hmm. He was really powerful. And he was fiery, too. And he was quick on his feet in terms of he could think well on his feet. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, he's the most charismatic person that I've ever met. White folks feared him and revered him mm-hmm. at the same time. Mm-hmm. You know, he still is. I mean, he's older now, but man, that he's the most charismatic person I've ever met, and he was the most articulate at that time. Mm-hmm. And he could rev up a crowd.
Right.
You know, he could rev up a crowd. So.
Was Florence? I'm not sure how to ask this question. There have been some people who have indicated that Florence was not a self-made man, that he was made by Alinsky, that he was made by Chambers and the Industrial Areas Foundation. I've heard plenty to counter that, mm-hmm. but how would you weigh in on that discussion?
Well, I think that you have to look at the whole concept of mentorship. As an example, mm-hmm. When you look at the fight Kodak struggle, mm-hmm. The whole idea of going to Flemington, New Jersey, mm-hmm. the whole idea of having stock proxies and using them to get into a shareholders meeting had never been done before and hasn't been done since. You know, as a matter of, you know, when you're looking at wanting to address an issue on behalf of poor people. Mm-hmm. Now, I think that, did Franklin think of that? No. I don't know how that came up. Did he think of it? I would venture to say he didn't. Mm-hmm. But did they tell him what to do and what not to do? No, nobody did that. Mm-hmm. But was Franklin willing to listen and learn? Yeah. Mm-hmm. We didn't know anything about organizing. We didn't know anything about tactics, that kind of stuff. So I think rather than being controlled or a product of them, I think what you had was a partnership.
Okay.
Where they didn't tell him what to do. They may have mentored him in areas where there may have been some, and I mean, when I use this term, I don't mean stupid, I mean
sure.
Ignorance.
Yep.
Ignorance, not knowing.
Absolutely.
Where there may have been some ignorance on his part, mm-hmm. on the part of our folk in particular. I mean, in general. He may not have had that knowledge base. Mm-hmm. So he took what they knew and tailored it to fit the situation and add to it his fireiness and his charisma. And there was a good team.
How does the relationship between Alinsky and his people and Fight come to be severed?
That happened with Bernie Gifford.
Okay.
I think Franklin, as good as he was, he made a lot of men, black men, to his credit, and I'm one of them. Mm-hmm. And I always use the phrase whenever I talk about him. For some people he mentored, they hung with him, and they just watched what he did. And he mentored them. Early on, I think we all started that way. But as good as he was with his fire, that it could be displaced. Uh-huh. And so when that fire began to be turned on a host of black folks, meaning control, mm-hmm. then some of us didn't really set well with that.
Can you give an example?
Well, me.
Okay.
When he taught me some solid principles, mm-hmm. and when the principles applied to him, then, okay, forget the principles, so to speak. And one of the things he used to always say, he said, I don't care if it's my mama or if it's my papa, if they're wrong, they're wrong. And so when the time came, and I was always concerned about the community and Fight, I loved him. But he taught me that he could not become the issue. That it was what was right, not who but what, mm-hmm. and you make your decisions based on what is right. Well, when Bernie Gifford won the election, and Franklin wanted to oppose that and fight that, and Bernie had won. And then Franklin wanted to oppose it and be what I felt was divisive, mm-hmm. as opposed to sitting down and being supportive of the new administration and working with the new administration and just being silent. And if he was asked to do something, you know, be supportive for the greater good. Mm-hmm. And if they didn't want his help, remain in the background for the greater good. Mm-hmm. He couldn't do that. Instead, he wanted to fight. He wanted to wrest back the control But in the process of that, I confronted him on something that he had done that it was a simple thing. Mm-hmm. He wasn't truthful with me. And I knew it. And as much as I talked about him, my friend, my father, my mentor, mm-hmm. you know, et cetera, I sit around and think about how I could take a bullet for him.
Yeah.
And, but for him to be wrong and not admit it, it caused the rift.
Sure.
And so it put me in a position where I had to either be a man, you know, his own man, or be a man who was controlled. And I wasn't going to be a man who was controlled. Mm-hmm. Not even with him, as much as I love him, I wouldn't do that. Mm-hmm. So I had to take a stand, and I did. And that caused a rift between us. And that was the hardest thing, in all honesty, that I think I've ever had to do in my life. Because we were that close. Mm-hmm. But I used his principles. If I don't care if it's my mama, it's my papa. If they're wrong, they're wrong.
Right.
And so he was like my papa. And he was wrong, and he wouldn't admit it. All I wanted him to do was say, I was wrong, I blew that, I'm sorry, and blah, blah, blah.
Right.
He would never do that.
Can you tell me a little bit about that election night? I've heard a number of reports about the divisiveness you refer to, that there was violence involved, that it was a very ugly evening. What are your recollections of that night?
Which one?
The election night at the convention, where Gifford wins the election.
Well, he won two.
Okay.
The first one. There was no violence. Bernie came in. By this time, you have to understand that Franklin had stepped on so many heads.
Yeah.
I mean, so many. And he had his foot on so many people's neck that they were tired of it. And so all of those enemies coalesced mm-hmm. and came against him.
Okay.
And there was the church community, the ministers, the black ministers, but by and large people didn't want to do it publicly.
Right.
Because they feared him. And so there were a lot of people with throwing rocks and hiding their hands. They were pretending to be close to him in his face, but in his back. Mm-hmm. So the long and the short of it was at that first one, and I guess that had to be around 1968 or 69. Mm-hmm. That's where what they call the controversial voice vote was taken.
Right.
Yeah.
I think you were describing this when we talked before. Can
yeah.
you describe again how that process worked?
Well, what it was that when everything was done by, they were trying to count the people. I forget how that was, but I think they were trying to count the people and so if they were for Florence, they stood up. If they were for Gifford, they stood up, you know, and mm-hmm. got counted. But on this particular occasion, when they stood up, Franklin knew he was losing, so he was going through the crowd getting people to move. So get count up here, and, you know, and just move right. around, just creating commotion.
You'll be counted a second time.
Yeah,
and
yeah. Just sure. create. I forget just what it was, but he was creating commotion, mm-hmm. and so they couldn't continue that way. So what Bernie's folks called for, and I was on staff at that time. I was on Franklin's staff, but I was just sitting in the back, mm-hmm. me and the other staff guy, organizer, Bob Jones was his name. And we were just watching the whole thing. And so what happened was Bernie and his folk got tired of that. So they called for a voice vote mm-hmm. rather than mm-hmm. the count.
Sure.
And Bernie won it. Mm-hmm. Franklin says there was discrepancy and that Bernie didn't win it, but Bernie won it.
So in a voice vote, it's whoever can make the most.
Who can make the most noise.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, that's what it was. All those in favor of Gifford, and people yelled. And all those in favor of Florence, and people yelled. And Franklin won. I mean, Bernie won it.
Mm-hmm.
Bernie won it.
Mm-hmm.
And I was sitting back there. Mm-hmm. And I knew the fight had because the year before, I knew the fight couldn't go on the way that it was the year that I worked there. Because prior to my coming to work for fight and coming back from school, they had had an election where Bernie ran against Franklin. He really didn't want to.
Mm-hmm.
But he had been asking Franklin all the time, are you going to run? Because everybody revered Franklin. Are you going to run? I don't want to run against you. If you're going to run, I'm not going to run. Tell me, are you going to run? And Franklin said, well, you know, I'll let you know. And so to Bernie's credit, he did. He right down to the last minute. And so Bernie was gearing up to run. And Franklin was saying he wasn't going to run. But Bernie would go back. I keep hearing these rumors. Are you going to run?
Mm-hmm.
Tell me. You know, I will not run against you. I don't want to run against you. You know, so are you going to run? And Franklin was saying no. And right up to the day, I guess, I wasn't here now. This is what mm-hmm. I'm talking about. But right up until the day before the convention, Franklin said, yeah. He would run. Well, it was too late for Bernie to turn at that particular point. So he went to the convention floor. And when they were looking, I wasn't there.
Mm-hmm,
so.
Sure.
But my understanding is that when they were looking for, when they were getting ready to take the count and everything, it was very clear to everybody that Bernie had the numbers.
Mm-hmm.
It was very clear. And a lot of this was a backlash against Franklin.
Right.
You know, they got sick of him having, he had professional people, like lawyers and all of that.
Because
mm-hmm. Franklin had whipped up on so many people. I mean, he could be loving and charismatic with you. He could draw you.
Mm-hmm.
And he could whip the daylights out of you. Mm-hmm. With his, you know, words.
Sure.
Oh, man.
Sure.
I've never met anybody like him who could do that.
Mm-hmm.
And so what happened was that all these people just rose up. And so Bernie had won it. But Bernie, in the last minute, went up and conceded. And that was the demise of the organization there.
Mm-hmm.
That was really the demise of it, because it was divided at that mm-hmm. point. It had been a unified group, and people maybe favored this one, but it was a unified group. But that was really the crystal clear division. And when I came back to Rochester, I was expecting to see the fight that I had seen and gone to meetings mm-hmm. and all that, and the spirit wasn't there.
Mm-hmm.
And it never returned. It never returned. That was the demise. So Bernie conceded, and it was a heck of a year. And I was doing organizing.
Mm-hmm.
It was a heck of a year trying to organize. And Bernie got approached to run again. And I remember going to somebody. A lady named, she's passed away, Beverly Majors, went to her to get her to organize a group. Because Fight was a member organization mm-hmm. of groups.
Yep.
And so I went to her to when we were preparing for the convention that year and said, Bev, you're going to look through the sheets that we have, the delegate sheets that we had. And I said, Bev, you had a group last year. And she said, no, I'm not going to bother with it this year. She said, if Bernie Gifford was going to run and he was serious, then I could get involved, but I'm not going to run. And not if he's going to do what he did last time. Bernie wasn't running. So finally enough people got to Bernie and talked him into running again and being serious this time. And, so Bernie decided he's going to run, and Bev Majors called me and said, bring me one of those delegate sheets, because I'm going to organize. So she did. I did, and she did. Mm-hmm. And people came out again this time, and this is where the controversial voice book occurred.
Yeah.
The Franklin caused controversy. It wasn't Bernie won.
Right.
And so that further exacerbated the fight demise. And from what it was originally, I mean, it was still a strong organization, but mm-hmm. from what it was. And then Bernie had a different style. He wasn't nowhere near as articulate as Franklin. He was smart, mm-hmm. very smart, intellectually,
sure.
well-read, but nowhere near the charisma that Franklin had.
So you said, you asked me earlier, which election night? So I think then that I'm referring to this second election.
There was no violence there.
I have been told there were that.
No,
that
that's the third one.
The third one. Let's get there then. Yeah, sorry.
Okay. So Bernie had to run. Bernie could run again.
Mm-hmm.
And Franklin this time got together and he had some people that were just kind of strong arms, for lack of a better term. So we had. You had people from one side of town, and then you had people from the other side of town. And so our strength was really, it was broad-based, because Bernie was the intellectual. He's a resident intellectual who had turned to community activists and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm.
So at this point, you're Gifford's vice president?
At this point, I'm going to run for his vice president.
With him, okay.
With him.
Okay.
And and that was a tough decision for me because
sure.
I was still a member of Franklin's church.
Right.
I'm still a minister there.
Mm-hmm.
So, but there were a lot of people in the church who were opposed to him
mm-hmm.
at that particular time.
Mm-hmm.
And so that house was divided, you know, because I hesitated to run because I didn't want to create any commotion in the church.
And he has not started Central Church of Christ.
No, no. This is at the Reynolds Street Church of Christ.
Right, okay.
So I didn't want to run originally, and then people begin to prevail upon me. And people in the community begin to prevail upon me. I was director of Hanover House's ministry, which gave me a base of support.
Right, sure.
Because that's where that was, people were there.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, and I had a good rapport
yep.
with all of those folks. So, Bernie's folks even begin to prevail for me to run, and I liked Bernie,
mm-hmm.
you know. But then people in the church begin to say, you know, if you're going to do that, you need to announce that. People would love to hear that, you know. What? Because most people just kind of viewed me with Franklin, you know. In the church. I don't want to do that. But he was just, in my estimation, he was just going further and further off the deep end at that time. And so the long and the short of it was that I decided to run. And Franklin was having a difficult time in so many places, getting support, maintaining support. He had established an organization called the 11th Ward Association. And so he had galvanized some people.
Mm-hmm.
And so when the time came for the election, it was clear that he wasn't going to be able to win. But he thought probably that Bernie was soft and that he could just take it. You know, take it. So they go in and they took over the stage. And this guy's early before the convention even started. Because we used voting machines this time.
Okay.
We used voting machines.
Okay.
So, So he resented that. He didn't want to do that, mm-hmm. you know, because if you create enough commotion, then some of the people ultimately begin to leave. And if they leave, then you can get their numbers lower than higher, you know, you can lower your opponent's numbers and keep yours high.
Yep.
So he wanted to be able to create commotion, but the voting machines wouldn't allow that because people come in all day. You know, from you declare the voting hours, people come in, place their vote from the community and go.
Right.
They show the membership card, come in, place their vote, go.
They don't have to be at a convention.
Yeah, they don't have to be at a convention and all that. Well, we were killing them in the votes. I mean, we were 600 and something to 100 and something, you know, something like that. And so he didn't want that. So he came in and heck with the voting machines, and he had his guys take over the stage, and they had red bandanas around their heads. They had iron pipes wrapped in crepe paper, and they took over the stage. And he and his leaders, I guess, were sitting on the side, but all these guys that he had with him, they took over the stage. And so we had gotten some of the guys from Joseph Avenue, the other side of town, to come over, and they were supporting us. And that's a story in and of itself.
That's one I'd like to hear.
These were street brothers.
Mm-hmm. And Florence has his street brothers.
Yeah, right? But these guys were street brothers.
Okay.
And Franklin's brothers, Franklin's guys were not as street as these guys were, Joseph Avenue.
So we're having the same conversation. I understand that Florence was widely supported by the Matadors, that there were some other groups, organizations that referred to themselves as gangs, and that they...
That was early on.
...offered protection for him.
That was early on.
Okay. So early this on. Is, we're talking a later period
later
now.
Later period. Initially, he was revered by, especially those folks, revered by him.
Mm-hmm.
But all of that, those guys had gotten older, and that had kind of died down at that particular point. During the Fight Kodak struggle, that was there.
Okay.
You know, but this is all after that.
Okay.
This is now 70, 69, no, 70. Okay. Right around 70, 69, 70.
Mm-hmm.
So,
you have these guys from Jefferson Avenue.
Yeah, and they're the ones that are on the stage on that side of town. And the guys from Joseph Avenue came and wanted to go take over the stage. And we said, no, nobody takes over the stage. Even Bernie wanted to take over the stage. I said, no. Nobody takes over the stage. Nobody goes on that stage. You know? Oh, no, they're making us look like punks. No, nobody takes over the stage. And I knew some of those guys, too. I mean, church and everything. Yeah.
Yep.
So, No, nobody goes on the stage. So then the guys on Joseph Avenue are getting frustrated with me. They're making us look like punks. I said, look, all of our guys, back into the bleachers. Back into the bleachers. And they said, and I remember one guy who later got killed said, I ain't nobody's guy. I said, man, come on, get in the bleachers, would you please? Get in the bleachers. He went up there, and they all sat up there. So I was over talking to another minister named Floyd Rhodes and Bernie was, you know, just going up and down. They're making us look, we got to take over this stage. They make us look like punks. I said, nobody goes on the stage, Bernie. Nobody goes on the stage.
And so, at this point, Florence and his people are still up there.
His people are still up there. He's sitting on the side.
Okay.
The stage is like this.
Yep.
He's sitting over inside with his people on that side of the stage.
Uh-huh.
We're way over here.
Okay.
On the other part of the auditorium.
Okay.
And his guys are on the stage, and they've just taken over the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
So I looked up while we were talking. I was trying to convince him to be cool. And Bernie to be cool, and I looked, and all of those guys had started filing out of the bleachers again. And they had enough, and they were going to go up on that stage. And they had guns, knives, straight razors, everything. The other guys had iron pipes and what else? Mm-hmm. I don't know. But I know what these guys had. Mm-hmm. And so they started out of the bleachers, and I jumped, and Floyd Rose, I didn't know Floyd that. I mean, I just knew Floyd as another minister. I didn't know him well. And I jumped when I saw them coming out of the corner of my eye. I was talking to Bernie, some coming out of the corner of my eye. And I just stopped talking. I ran over to the stairs to the stage, and there was a pole here, stairs here, mm-hmm. and then a pole here, mm-hmm. and then stairs, and then a pole. And I remember I jumped, ran, I don't know how I did it, but I jumped over the first pole. Mm-hmm. I didn't run up the stairs, I just jumped over the pole and wound up in the middle and stood between these guys that were trying to come up the stairs and these guys that were on the stage, because mm-hmm. they had all filed over to the top of the stairs. Mm-hmm. And I said, look, stay back. And I looked over, and Floyd Rose had come over behind me, and he jumped into the middle of these, mm-hmm. and I was over here. Mm-hmm. Get back, man. Go back up in the bleachers, man. Yeah, get back. And his guys were at the top waiting. You
know, and Florence's guys.
Florence's guys mm-hmm. were at the top of the stairs waiting. And get back. Go back. And finally, then one of the guys pushed me. One of the guys from my church pushed me. A guy named Lee Elliott pushed me. And one of his guys said to him, Lee, what are you doing? His name was John Reynolds. Mm-hmm. He said, Lee, he's a member of church too. Lee, what are you doing? He said, Scott is trying to break this thing up. And what are you pushing it for? He's not coming up here. He said, he's not trying to come up here. He said, he's trying to break it up. And what are you doing pushing him? And I said, look, I'm trying to stop this. You guys obviously want some trouble, because it would be to their advantage.
Sure.
If that was the case, because they didn't have the numbers.
Right.
So the whole thing could be called off. So it had been to their advantage. Well, no. He said, man, no, well, he's not trying to start. He's trying to break it up. Well, long and short is, our guys got back into the bleachers, and then the ministers came in from some of the larger churches, and they went over and talked to Franklin. And he was saying to them, where were you last year? Where were you last year? Because he wanted to voice vote again. Where were you last year? Where were y'all last year? Long and short of it was, he pulled his people out of the convention and declared victory. Mm-hmm. Well, we thought that was the end. It wasn't. It wasn't. So then he began to come over to fight headquarters, and demanding the keys to the office and demanding, you know, mm-hmm. the office and so on and so forth.
That night, were you and Gifford jumped?
No, this was what I'm getting ready to tell you.
Okay.
That's when we were. Uh-huh. So night after, on different occasions, they would come over to the office, a whole group of them, mm-hmm. demanding that we turn over the office to them and turn over. So this went on for maybe a week or two. So finally, people got tired, and I went over. They called me from home, and then I'd go back over there. And I was still trying to mediate. And they said, the long and the short of it was, let's leave the office. Everybody's going to leave the office. We're all going to go home. And they said, well, you better not open back up. You better not open back up. If you do, we'll be back. We'll be back. Look, man. Everybody leave the office. We're leaving. You better not open back up. So I remember walking out. Some guys came out of the office. We stepped down about three stairs. That's where the office is situated. And walked down this little hallway. Mm-hmm. And come out of this office. There were some guys coming out of there. And there were guns mothered in that little office.
Right.
And so they come filing out with these guns. And they walk outside. And these guys said, what y'all gonna do with those, or something like that. And then one of the guys turned around and said something to one of their guys. They walked out. And so I'm still trying to mediate. And I had gone back home. I had gone to my house over on Joseph Avenue. And I remember being on the phone with these guys, with Franklin's guys, back, still trying to mediate.
Yeah.
I said, man, we need to quit this, man. You know, we're not each other's enemies. You know,
right.
We're not the enemy. Mm-hmm. And we were having these conversations on the phone. So I left. We hung up, and I stepped outside, did something, and then been there for a little while. My wife wasn't home. My kids weren't home. And I got out of, I was going to go down to the headquarters. We had headquarters on Joseph Avenue, too, in addition to the one on Prospect. And when I got ready to, I walked outside to get in my car. And I did a U-turn in the street at Joseph and Kelly. And as I did, this car pulled up to where my car was parked on this side of the street. So now I'm over here. I just turned around, I'm over here. Mm-hmm. And I saw all these guys, and I knew them all, you know, and from church, a couple of them from church. And it looked like they were going to my house. So I just said, hey, are you guys looking for me?
Right.
And so I thought they wanted to talk, you know. So they came over, and one of them said, there he goes. And I'm like that. And so they came over, and I'm just naive. Mm-hmm. And they grabbed me out of my car. One of them kneed me in the side. And they took me over to their car and put me in it. And one of them, while I was in the car, I said, what's wrong with y'all, man? And one of them hit me. And so then I said, what is going on? Well, what I learned was that those guys with the guns that came out, went over and shot up the headquarters. And while there were a lot of people in it, and fortunately nobody got killed, nobody got hit, mm-hmm. but they shot up the headquarters. So they thought I had something to do with that, mm-hmm. and or that I knew, or that I was just going to be the patsy. Mm-hmm. And so they came and got me, and they took me over to the headquarters where the police were. And the police, when they saw what they had done, came to the car and told them to back off and took me out of their car and put me in the police car. Mm-hmm. And then a little while later, I learned, Bernie comes, they come with him in the car. Mm-hmm. And they had gone to his house, mm-hmm. and suckered him outside and then put him in the car and jacked him up a little bit, I guess, and then brought him over to the headquarters, too. But it did more damage to them than it did to us, because both of us acted innocently.
Right.
Well, but that was the end of their group, because the people were afraid, having been shot at. This thing wasn't about getting killed over. Mm-hmm. So that was the demise of their group. People mm-hmm. stopped, and their group stopped coming around.
Yeah.
They stopped coming around. So that was the demise of their group, and that's what brought at least peace to... That put an end to that, them trying to come over and mm-hmm. take over the office and all that kind of stuff.
It sounds to me, based on what you've described, based on what I've heard from some other people, that there is, at least at this time, a lot of male posturing in fight, surrounding fight. Mm-hmm. What are all the women doing?
Being supportive. I think at the time, too, you have to understand that when you look at black males have systematically, historically been emasculated.
Sure.
By white males, mm-hmm. in particular, by society, being fearful of them. Mm-hmm. And so black women have been systematically exalted and used and misused. And at that time, we were coming to an awareness of those kinds of things. I mean, and it still goes on very subtly. The guy that should have been president of Xerox was a guy named Barry Rand. Check it out. Ask anybody. He's a black guy. He was told by the then leader of the corporation that was leaving the corporation, the business community is not ready for a black man to lead Xerox. So they put that jerk in there that messed it up. And they're still paying him to this very day, and his wife. I forget his name now, but if you do the research, you can find out. But Barry should have been the president. Well, look at what has happened. They didn't get a black man. They got a white man. And then they got another white man. And then what? The president of the leader of Xerox today is a white woman. Now, she's the, I forgot how, she's the chief operating officer. Mm-hmm. Who is the president? A beautiful black woman named Ursula Burns.
Mm-hmm. How are we on the tape?
You're really out.
I thought we were about that at that time. Right. Do you want to switch?
Sure. Let's see.
Well, I think, you know what, the restroom?
Absolutely. If I'll walk out the room.
We're getting it all on there. Right. Still kind of, right. And if you just missed a little bit here, I wouldn't be able to recover. Right. So I just
no,
said,
I'm glad
that that's I knew we were running out, but that was one. I thought, and it so happened that both of them were. The first one was with Attica, and then we were at these
difficult places,
moments that just couldn't.
Your friend asked me the last time you got here. Mm-hmm. I remember him saying in utter amazement, you don't have any presidential papers?
Right.
You know. Well, Bernie's the kind of guy that would keep that.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, I was talking to Sister Grace Miller,
mm-hmm.
Who was around every moment of fight.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very supportive, still an activist.
Mm-hmm.
I was talking to her the other day, talking about doing this interview, and she was elated over it. And she said, you know, she said, it really, really upsets me. She said, I had everything about fight. Everything. She said, I had everything. I had in a box all the news clippings, all the you know. Mm-hmm. She would even go sometimes, maybe be out to dinner, and she'd be sitting behind a senator, and she could take notes from shorthand, and mm-hmm. she'd write down everything they said. Mm-hmm. And it was about fighting, mm-hmm. you know. So she had all this, she said, and one of the guys, while she was away at school, went over to the convent where she lived and asked for her fight information. And they looked through the convent, found it, and gave it to him. And she's never seen it since.
So, oh, that's tragic.
Yeah. But she said, I had everything. And she was, she's one that still, she reads the newspaper every day.
Mm-hmm.
So she had everything that involved fight, anything. Yeah. She had the meetings that we had, that we busted up, or whatever. Mm-hmm. She had all of that. Fight conventions.
Sure.
She had all of that.
So you were saying before we broke there for a minute that was the role of women, that they were largely supportive of this movement.
Yeah. Well, they were supportive of the movement primarily because they wanted to see the emergence of the black male in leadership.
Mm-hmm.
And I related how it still shows up today with the leadership of Xerox and Ursula Burns being a black female.
Mm-hmm.
And black women have historically held positions of leadership. White men were not threatened by them.
Right.
They were threatened by white black males. Mm-hmm. And so black women were pushing the men out front and willing at that particular time to take a subservient role.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's where they were. They were very, very present. Very present.
Give me some examples of how.
Well, in any movements, like I said, that we if we had to go to the city council meetings
mm-hmm.
to make our point, and we were going to be disruptive and that kind of thing. The two times that we almost got into literal fights with the police were over black women being vocal.
Mm-hmm.
One in particular was Mary Davidson.
Okay.
And the policeman had tried to subdue some cab drivers who were there on an issue. And when they went back and tried to, you know, get them to leave and all that, they pushed one of them, and then they got into a shoving match and that kind of thing. And the union leader of the police officers stood up to the city council and said, "Mayor Frank, stop this." You know what I mean? So the mayor calmed them down and everything, mm-hmm. and nobody got arrested and everything. And
mm-hmm.
so then a little while later, Mary Davidson was always vocal. You mentioned fight. You can mention fight without mentioning Mary Davidson. She's passed on now. But she was very vocal and loud. And so she stood up and said something from the city council chambers. And the police, the mayor said, "Sit down. Sit down." And she said, she didn't sit down.
Mm-hmm.
She just stood there. He said, "Sit down." He said, "Arrest that woman. Arrest that woman." And I can hear still Franklin saying, "No, you don't. No, you don't." And he rushed towards her. And and when he rushed toward her, he said, "Get up, brothers. Get up." And everybody rushed around her, you know. Mm-hmm. And he said, "You're not going to touch her," you know.
Mm-hmm.
I forgot how it happened, but they backed off.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't touch her. We all stood up, and they didn't touch her.
Right.
And then when Franklin got up to speak about the issue for which we were there, he said, "This is a classic example of a double standard." You know, those guys were physical with them, the cab drivers. They were physical with them.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't arrest not one of them.
Right.
But then this woman, this black woman, stands up, and she just speaks and refuses, and she spoke at first, but then she just stood there.
Mm-hmm.
And then they're gonna
and these cab drivers
her.
Were white.
And the cab drivers were white.
Sure.
Yeah. Yeah.
Sure.
So they were gonna arrest them mm-hmm. and arrest her. So that didn't happen. Mm-hmm. The other one was a lady named Dolores Walker. She did the same kind of thing. This was during my administration. Mm-hmm. She did the same thing, and they were going to arrest her. And I said, "Don't you touch her." And I told her all the brothers to get up. And we went up, rushed to the front, and stood around her in front of her. Mm-hmm. And the mayor told the cops to back off. Mm-hmm. So they were vocal, but they chose to take a more supportive role to elevate the black man. Mm-hmm. And they understood what that emasculation has looked like. Mm-hmm. And there's some feelings about what that emasculation was doing to black homes.
Right.
And so the move was afoot at that particular time to mm-hmm. put black men.
Sure. I was hoping I could get you to retell the story you had told Michael and I about the two white women that came to fight headquarters that day demanding to see.
Yeah. Well, it was just not going to be a good thing to. They came. The names were Hope Harden and Mary Grooms, mm-hmm. and they were going around attacking black organizations and calling them poverty pimps and all of that. Mm-hmm. And so they then decided to, and they were both. I think they both were writers.
Okay.
At one point, or guest essayist or something for the mm-hmm. Democratic Chronicle. So they decided that, and they didn't like what we did with the Preservation District either.
Okay.
And they were against us on that because they wanted it to be a Preservation District, and we won. So they started going to black organizations. I don't know whether they went to Urban League, but I know they went to ABC and demanded to see their annual report.
Right.
Or something to that effect,
mm-hmm.
and or their audit, the it's the thing that they do at the end of the year. The accountants do. I guess it's an audit.
Yeah. The year-end audit.
Year-end audit. Yeah.
Fiscal report.
Yeah, fiscal report. So they wanted to see it, and so they went to ABC, and Jim McCullough said sure, and he gave it to them, and they said, well, next they go to fight. And I said, we want to see it. They said, we want to see it. And I said, well, we're not giving it to you. They said, then we're not leaving. We're just going to sit here. And we'll stay here until you give it to us.
Mm-hmm.
I said, okay. So I went back to my office, called folk together, and I said, I'm going to call around to various offices and to other agencies that are friends. There were five at the time. Come over here. So I called them all. Again, it was mostly women. I called them all. I said, look, you guys, nothing to do with this. You ladies? I said, I got a meeting with the president of Marine Midland Bank in 15 minutes. So I'm going to leave here. I said, but after I walk out of here, I said, I don't want to see them women here when I get back. I said, so y'all escort them out of here. I said, I don't want to do it. No guys. I said, y'all escort them out of here. I said, I don't want them here when I get back. So they said they're going to stay all day. I said, okay. So I left. And when I got downtown, I heard that they had picked them up, literally, and put them out into the street. And they never came back.
Mm-hmm.
They never came back. So we had to go to court behind that. And the judge threw it out.
Mm-hmm.
Just woman Pat, he threw it out.
Mm-hmm.
So, but they were always active. And black women still are.
Yeah.
You know. But at that particular time, everybody was recognizing the emasculation of the black male.
Mm-hmm.
And so women were supportive of, you know, rectifying that situation.
Sure. We have to wrap up, and I've kept you here so much longer than I said I would.
Sure.
Are there other things that you think we haven't covered? Other things that are important to this story that we haven't got at?
Well, I think you have to look at the results mm-hmm. of all of this.
Okay, what are they?
In 1975, I think it was, we ran Ronald Good for the city council.
Mm-hmm.
It was the first time a concerted effort like that was done.
Mm-hmm.
One prominent financier and industrialist in the Rochester area had said he would die, a white guy,
mm-hmm.
he would die and go to hell before he saw a spear chucker on city council. And so we ran Ron Good. And we knew that Ron could win because everybody loved him. He was a gentleman's gentleman.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody loved him.
Mm-hmm.
White people loved him. Black people loved him. Everybody loved him. He was just a nice guy. Very smart man. Very astute.
Mm-hmm.
Not a rebel rouser.
Right.
You know.
He's not a Franklin Florence.
Not a Franklin Florence.
Mm-hmm.
But a gentleman. And everybody loved him, but we needed to see a black face on city council. And that was my agenda.
Mm-hmm.
And Constance Mitchell
sure.
ran on the other side of town.
Mm-hmm.
And Ron, the long and short of it was that Ron won.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, the night of the election, Ron ended up with 848 votes to Urban Kress's 848 votes, and they couldn't believe it. Urban Kress, I remember him saying, wow, they must have pulled him out of the woodworks, you know, because they thought he was a shoo-in. We just didn't win anything in terms of politics against white candidates. We didn't win anything.
Right.
So Ron showed up a tie, 848 to 848.
Mm-hmm.
I was in the county legislative office building and in the chambers, and that's where they used to count the votes by hand, where they count them someplace else by hand, and they would post the results in the legislative chambers on boards.
Mm-hmm.
And I walked in, me and I forgot who the other person was, but this was that night after the election, and I walked in and looked on the board, and it said, Constance Mitchell, 1291.
Mm-hmm.
Christopher Lindley, 1242.
Mm-hmm.
Chris Lindley was a fair-haired boy of the Democratic Party at that particular time, and for him to lose.
This is a primary race.
This was a primary race.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So for him to lose, it would have been, oh man, it would have been a slap in the face to Larry Kerwin, who was the popular Democratic Party chairman.
Mm-hmm.
So, long or short of it was Chris, it said 1291 to 1242. And the guy wrote final across the top of it.
Mm-hmm.
So we're standing there for whatever reasons, still standing there. The guy goes downstairs and he comes back up maybe about 15, 20 minutes later.
Mm-hmm.
Takes those numbers down and writes Constance Mitchell 1242, Chris Lindley 1242. Tie. I said, what? So then they have to count the absentee ballots.
Mm-hmm.
And the long and the short of it was, and after that, between the time that they were going to count the absentee ballots, Ron Good said to me, I know what's going to happen. He said, I already know. He didn't tell me how. He said, but I'm going to win. Mrs. Mitchell is going to lose. They weren't going to give us both of them.
Right.
So he winds up winning she winds up losing by 2 votes. Well, that whole situation did what it was supposed to be. It was a gross injustice to Connie and the community. Mm. But it did what it was supposed to do. It let black folks know that they could win. The floodgates opened.
Right.
Today, there are, I think, 4 blacks on city council and 1 Hispanic.
Out of 9?
Out of 9.
That's impressive.
Yeah. And whenever black folk did something, Hispanics tended to follow. Mm-hmm.
Sure.
You know.
Sure.
So, and on the city school board, mm-hmm. there may have been 1, 2, and now if you look at it, the blacks and Hispanics there hold a majority as well.
Mm-hmm.
So my point is that all of that comes on the heels. David Gant, I was his campaign manager
sure.
for his first 2 campaigns mm-hmm. in county legislature. We talked him into running and bucked the party and everything. Ron Good came after that.
Mm-hmm.
But David is now he's the first black state assemblyman in the history of this town, and he's also therefore the first dean of the Monroe County delegation,
mm-hmm.
you know. And he's true to form. I mean, his mother was an activist, and she was a pistol.
Yeah.
And so he came from that stock, and he behaves that way. And he doesn't do things for popularity. He does things based on what he thinks is right. And whoever doesn't like it, too bad. And people love him for that.
Yeah.
Well, so now he's the first black dean of the Monroe County delegation. I was just at a function last week where T. Andrew Brown was selected as the first black president of the Bar Association, the Monroe County Bar Association.
Mm-hmm.
All of that comes on the heels of what we did back then.
It's the legacy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And Andrew recognized that in his speech.
Mm-hmm.
When he mm-hmm. did his, and it was, had the largest audience that they've ever had at one of their annual functions for the presidency.
It's fantastic.
Yeah. So, you look at things like that, and T. Andrew Brown. You've got in this town we've had a black superintendent of schools a few times,
mm-hmm.
But all of that was unheard of during that day, and I guess some of us who were visionaries could foresee the day when,
mm-hmm.
but most people could not. When you look at the blacks in particular in high level positions within Xerox, the director of human resources at Bausch & Lomb is a brother named Clay Osborne.
Mm-hmm.
I guess all of this comes on the heels of what was done back then.
Yeah.
And again, one of the reasons that I agreed to share is that that's not remembered. And I just think about some of the things that we went through. Frank, all of the presidents of fight, at least Franklin, Bernie Gifford, and myself got threats.
Sure.
From whites. And at one point, there was a deer head that was put on a church step on North Street with my name on it. You know, and this is what's going to happen to Reverend Sick Scott, you know, as I see. I got several of those from somebody who identified me that way as Sick, as I see, and threatening letters. And we all went through that. And as a result of that, us being willing to go through it, we have what we have today. From my perspective, there's no reverence that I seek. There's no glowing accolades that I seek.
Mm-hmm.
I'm glad that people are doing well.
Mm-hmm.
But I would not want them to forget how they got where they are and think that they did it on their own, because then they're not obligated to pay it forward.
Right.
And whoever is, wherever he is or she is, I want them to feel obligated to pay it forward.
There's still a lot of work to be done.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So.
Thank you so much.
Okay.
I appreciate you giving your time.
Good. Good.
Really, really fine. I had to...
Sure.